Time to check in and find out the latest at the casinos here in Northwest Indiana and the rest of the state. We'll also take this advantage to talk a little bit from the State House. It's time to check in with Ed Feigenbaum, who's the creator and the editor and publisher of the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter. Ed's with us from his office in Indianapolis area. Ed, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Hey, I always appreciate the opportunity, Chris.
Well, if you will, tell us how the Indiana Gaming Commission seems to have taken a look at the data from all of the casinos, including the boats here in Northwest Indiana. How did things shape up here in January?
Well, it was a tough month for the boats, and that was kind of unexpected given the nice weather and the fact that gas prices still seem to be down, and we didn't have any kind of other unique confluences of circumstances like we had with the Cubs World Series run in October and September of last year and Bears playoff run or something like that in January. So we expected a little bit more. And overall, statewide, revenues were down by a little bit over 3.75%. I think a lot of that can be explained away by the fact that we had one fewer Friday and one fewer Saturday in the 2017 calendar than we had in the 2016 January calendar.
What is the turnout from the standpoint of the local boats, how they seem to have done in January? Are they, that they have ups and downs, as I know they sometimes do?
Yeah, the win for the five boats in the Lake Michigan region was about $75 million. That was down by a little bit more than 5%, by about 5.3%, or about $4 million from January 2016. Now, if you look back a year to January 2016, that had been the strongest set of January numbers that Northwest Indiana had seen in 4 years. I think if you look back, you know, you realize they had some pretty severe January weather, you know, record cold, snow, wind, and ice back in January 2014, obviously. But the numbers are not necessarily going in the direction you want them to go in. And let me caution you and your listeners that when you see the February numbers a month from now, you will also probably see that those numbers are down perhaps a shade year over year, even though, again, the weather is starting out to be pretty nice for February. But we simply have one fewer day in February 2017 than we had in February 2016 because of the leap year.
Yeah, that's right. I know you have a chance to talk with some of the people at the individual casinos from time to time. Do the general managers at the casinos have maybe a strategy that they can prepare when they have these down months, whether it's just an occasional one or if it happens to run in a string of months, how they can be able to deal with it and keep the day-to-day operations going, and in particular, keep the promotions going? Because I know that means they probably have to sell the boats, so to speak, a lot harder than maybe they might have to otherwise.
Yeah, although it might even be a little bit counterintuitive, Chris, because a lot of the boats will kind of dial back a little bit on promotions during January because they're not certain, looking out, you know, a month or two when they schedule these promotions, what the weather will be like on a given day or a weekend. So it's a little bit difficult to say, okay, well, we'll do this particular drawing to get people in on this particular Wednesday because Wednesdays, you know, are very slow days for the casinos, but they're a little bit reluctant to do that and schedule those things that far out in advance because of weather issues in January in particular. So what you do is you look at trying to boost, for example, at Horseshoe Casino Hammond, where they've got the venue, you try and boost the entertainment option. Mm-hmm. You've got a concert on a Friday or Saturday night or something to kind of bump up that weekend attendance. That becomes a little bit more difficult for Majestic Star and for Ameristar because they don't have that kind of an entertainment venue that can give them that option. And they're reliant upon promotions, whether it's extra points for playing slots on a given day or, you know, some type of special meal opportunity or, again, you know, the special drawings or giveaways in order to draw people in. But it's very difficult when you're dealing with winter weather.
Are we also seeing, too, that strong competition from the casinos over in Illinois and especially the ones in Michigan and off to the east of us?
Yeah, I think that the competition from the Illinois casinos may have been a little bit overrated in January. The Illinois casinos on the west side of your border were down by literally the same percentage as the Northern Indiana casinos for the month. But what I think you're seeing is that the higher value players, the more serious players, the table game players, are still showing up at the Northern Indiana casinos. You're seeing that based on the table drop, the amount of money that's wagered at the tables. Those dollars seem to be very consistent over the last four Januaries in particular, last four Decembers as well. The coin in, the amount of money that people play at the slot machines is down a little bit. So I think that rather than competition so much from the Illinois casinos, you're seeing some of the lower value players stay home and play the BGTs in Illinois and not come out to the casinos in the Chicagoland area, whether they're in Illinois or Northwest Indiana.
We're talking with Ed Feigenbaum, who's the editor, creator of the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter based out of central Indiana. Ed, we know that not only do the casinos have to worry about how the overall revenues are doing, because they're counting on that, communities too, like Hammond and East Chicago and the like, are concerned about how the revenues at their particular area casinos are doing, because they get a share of that in turn too. And now I know now too, at the State House, there's a bill that is being proposed that would be affecting gaming taxes even more. Tell us what State Representative Todd Houston and his supporters have in mind about making some changes to the state gaming taxation situation.
Well, what they had in mind and what's going to come out of it are probably two different things. Mm-hmm. Representative Houston took on the thankless task of trying to adjust the distribution of what they call the supplemental revenues, the hold harmless dollars, to the local communities that host riverboats. Now, a few years ago, when we changed some of the admissions formulas, the state agreed to set aside about $48 million from the general fund to help compensate and supplement some of these local dollars, because they knew that they'd be getting less from the admissions tax. Now, over the last few years, it's become very difficult for the state to even get up to that $48 million. The state is essentially double subsidizing. You know, the state's having to come up with that money from the general fund from somewhere else, and then pay it back to the local communities. As a result, legislators realized they needed to take a look at it, and Representative Houston, who serves on both the House Committee on Ways and Means and the House Committee on Public Policy, the two principal committees that deal with the casinos and the funding that comes and goes through them, drafted a piece of legislation that would have reduced the supplemental distribution, the amount of money that goes from the state general fund to the local communities, from $48 million annually to $30 million annually. Now, of course, that created a huge hue and outcry from the local communities around the state. You know, not only do these communities use this as part of their general fund budget in some cases, but for other kinds of programs, the scholarship program in Hammond, for example. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have committed, particularly in the southern part of the state, a lot of them have committed some of these revenues going forward to paying off general obligation debt and to debt specifically related to infrastructure improvements for the casinos. So this money is very important to them. They made their case in a series of pilgrimages by mayors and county commissioners, county council members to visit with Representative Houston last Thursday, and Thursday the 2nd, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And Representative Houston kind of heard their complaints, their concerns, and adjusted the bill so that the amount of money that would be cut would be significantly reduced, and that the time period over which this would be phased in would be significantly lengthened, so the community would be able to compensate for a whole lot less in losses over a longer period of time.
I would imagine in communities, the smaller ones that you mentioned, like Lawrenceburg, where they have a casino there, it's a small community, and they've probably had to make some major road improvements in their own community to be able to get out to the boat and other things as well, too. And if they've got bond issues for those, it's going to be tough to pay those bonds off, as you can see. And they're counting on that revenue just as much as the city of Hammond counts on the revenue for the the scholarship program, and each city councilman in Hammond gets a share of the revenue for his own particular district to take care of projects, road work and the like, and that they have to pay for as well, too. Everybody's worried about that. So as you say, this is far from a final product, I guess, and there'll be more adjustments made here before it finally comes up either for a vote or at least comes up on the floor for consideration.
Right. It's recommitted to the Committee on Ways and Means, on which Representative Houston serves, and then the whole House will get a shot at it, and then it will be the Senate's turn. But it's interesting that you mentioned Lawrenceburg, because Lawrenceburg actually gets a huge chunk of cash from their vote there, and this was kind of the poster community a few years ago, and the legislative push kind of changed the way that the distribution formula was set up, because they felt that Lawrenceburg in particular was getting too much money. Now, Lawrenceburg mm-hmm. came back and said, hey, look at all the changes that we've made based on your recommendations, and now we don't even keep all that money. You know, we distribute that money to, I think it's more than a dozen different communities and other kinds of causes and whatever locally, you know, at the behest of the legislature. So, all this, you know, we did what you told us to do, and now you're coming back and trying to hurt us again. But again, that change has gone from a proposed $18 million cut to just a proposed $4 million cut. It'll be phased in, and then there's even a little bit of help on that $4 million.
And we'll bring up the topic of the city of Lawrenceburg, not because it's certainly not around here. It's about as far away from Northwest Indiana as you just about can get going to the south and east. But the idea is that small communities, as well as big ones like Hammond and to a lesser extent East Chicago here in Northwest Indiana, are going to feel a real serious impact if they find the tax revenue is going to be cut back as well, too. Ed, let's talk here about some other issues before the legislature. Are there any other gaming-related bills other than this one in particular, and dealing with the casino taxes that have come up?
Well, this bill also deals with casino taxes specifically. You know, the casinos have been fighting to get rid of the admissions tax. Mm-hmm. It's particularly detrimental to Michigan City, the way that they have their complex set up. And they pay over 4%, about 4.4% of their revenues in admissions taxes, where some of the other casinos pay closer to 2.2%, maybe 2.6% of their AGR, like Horseshoe Hammond, for the admissions tax. So what the legislature is looking at doing is kind of folding the admissions tax in to the wagering tax, doing away with the separate admissions tax, but making it revenue neutral for the state overall. Now, some casinos, like Horseshoe Hammond, which pays a smaller percentage of the AGR and the admissions tax now, would be hurt, but others like Blue Chip, which pays a much larger percentage, would be helped. Overall, though, it would be revenue neutral to the state.
Ed, let's take one final moment here as we have our chance to talk today to take a look at some other issues in particular, since you have a close eye on what happens in the General Assembly when they have sessions like this one, where they're dealing with writing a budget and a lot of big money bills, as we already know, is under consideration on infrastructure, roads and bridges in particular, and even beyond that, no doubt. We know now that Governor Eric Holcomb has made some executive decisions. It's maybe surprise to some people what he did, but we've actually seen here now that we are actually going from the Pence administration directly into the Holcomb administration, and you can see a definite change in there. What's your take on that?
Well, absolutely. You know, you might even say that a good bit of the Pence legacy was undone in one day by, you know, three executive orders from the governor and by two veto override votes by the House of Representatives on Wednesday. There's a real change in attitude on the second floor of the State House and to a certain extent on the third floor of the State House as well, and things are different than they were in the last 4 years.
Ed Feigenbaum is the creator and editor of newsletters, not only for the gaming industry here in Indiana, but taking a look at other policy matters as well, too, especially when it comes to state policy. Ed, thanks once again for being with us, and we hope to have you back on again soon.
Thank you, Chris.
And Ed Feigenbaum also says that a bill that would authorize a new casino in Terre Haute is coming up for a vote before the House Public Policy Committee on Wednesday. The Gary Chicago International Airport is planning for the future, at least for the next 10 years. And the first in what is to be a series of public workshops is going to be held this evening at 6 o'clock. It'll be held in the airport terminal, and they'll be reviewing work on the master plan. And to talk about all this, we have the chairman of the Gary Chicago International Airport Authority, Stephen Mace, with us. Mr. Mace, thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking. Tell us, if you will, what the master plan is to be all about and how important it is for not only the current activities at the airport, but for the airport's future.
Well, thank you, Chris, and it's a pleasure to be with you. As you well know, the master plan will have us envision to work forward in the next 10 to 20 years. We will be looking at all aspects of the airport. We'll be looking at infrastructure, and we'll look at aviation and growth. And it's always great to have a plan to guide you to get to where we need to be and where we're trying to go.
And I know that the airport's had some great success in what projects have been done in the, I guess, wrapping up the last master plan. The biggest and the most visible, of course, is the extension of the main runway and all the work that was involved in that. What are you hoping that this plan will be able to prove for the next 10 years or so?
Well, you're right, Chris. As you well know, in the last plan that we had in 2001, it showed the need for runway extension, and we planned the runway extension. So now we want to expand on that and look at the availability to plan and open a new customs and border facility that will help us be able to have the customs a facility. Also, we're looking at infrastructure. As you well know, it's been a lot of growth at the airport since 2014, about a 17.8% increase in annual operations. Mm-hmm. And the extended has really helped out in that area.
What does the firm Jacobson Daniels have on the plate as they come into this project? They've taken on a pretty ambitious project, I imagine, in helping the Airport Authority work on this plan and what is planned for the future as well. What are they going to be bringing up at these public workshops that are getting underway?
Well, the main thing, and Jacobson Daniels, we're very happy to have us from. They have a wealth of aviation experience. They've done master plans at airports all across the country, and we're glad to have them. Among some of the things that the plan will include, we'll look at our aviation forecast and the aviation demand for the region for the next 20 years. And that could mean very significant things for the airport. They'll also assess and make recommendations for the airport's current infrastructure and potential needs. And also, they'll make recommendations on land use on and around the airport.
I know that Jacobson Daniels has been working very closely with some Northwest Indiana firms, firms based in Gary in particular, to help get this project moving along here. Tell us how these subcontractors that are working with Jacobson Daniels are fitting into the picture, so to speak.
Well, we have a lot of local contractors and suppliers that had a chance to participate. Last spring, when we started the plan, Jacobs Daniels included a lot of local contractors and suppliers as a part of the operating team. And they've helped us develop this plan. It's also increased employment in the area and opportunities. When we had that event, we had about 70 companies that attended, and that's one of the reasons why we're very pleased with Jacobson Daniels.
Well, you've talked here, Mr. Mays, about what, as far as infrastructure is concerned, is to be looked at in the future for the Gary Chicago International Airport. How much will the master plan take a look at the physical growth, but the business growth as well, too?
Well, as a the board authority to forecast what our financial needs are going to be. So, you know, what we need to invest in, what infrastructure we need to buy and purchase, how we need to develop land around the airport. Right now, we are experiencing, as you well know, both of our FBOs have major projects. The Coleman has recently opened a potentially 7-year plan to do $20 million in investment in four new aircraft hangars. at Gary Jett Center is also opening up a new terminal, which is going to open in the second half of 2016. So we expect to grow. We expect to have the things happen. And so we're planning on that right now.
We're talking with Stephen Mays, who is the chairman of the Gary Chicago International Airport Authority, about the upcoming start of the series of public workshops dealing with the master plan update. That first such workshop is coming this evening, beginning at 6 o'clock. It'll be after the Airport Authority board meeting, and it'll be held at the airport terminal in Gary. Mr. Mays, we mentioned we have more meetings that are coming up. Can you tell us what if you have a timetable for those yet, if they're going to be there at Gary, or are they going to be another location so that more residents of the community can attend and find out more?
Well, we're planning on having at least 3 community presentations and workshops over the next 9 to 12 months. Right now, the plans are to have them at the Gary Airport, and we look forward to making sure all of the community residents and businesses attend. We've invited all of the different surrounding communities, and we would like to have input from the community and develop this master plan. The other thing, we're going to have availability on our website where people can make comments and recommendations, and it'll be open as well because a lot of people want to do things electronically. So we welcome the community, and we look forward to seeing everyone there to participate.
I know that there are a lot of people who are going to be very, very anxiously awaiting to see what plans are in the future for the Gary Chicago International Airport as the airport expands itself physically and business-wise. And we know that it's a key part of the economy in Northwest Indiana. And we know that all the economists always say that it's very important that the airport continue to grow, continue to show the interest in bringing more business into Northwest Indiana. And I'm sure that everybody's very, very interested in finding out what kind of plans are going to be drafted here in the future. Is there a timetable, if things move well, when you hope that the master plan update is going to actually take place and you can actually start working with it?
Well, I believe that in forecasting that will probably be done by the first quarter 2018. As we form plans and we work through and have a working document, we will make some changes as a board and implement things as we work along before the plan is completed. We'll be working in that area. But that's our current forecast.
So we're looking that maybe we'll actually get to see something here in about a year from now then. That's a pretty quick work for work on projects like this.
Yes, it is. And Jacobs and Dave is working very aggressively. Everyone is excited. And our request and how we make decisions have to be timely. So we have to be shovel ready for any projects. And we have to be at the forefront. So they're working very hard. Everyone is excited and working hard. And we are wanting to implement as soon as possible.
We're talking with Stephen Mays. He's the chairman of the Gary Chicago International Airport Authority Board about the series of public workshops beginning this evening at the Gary Airport Terminal to review and talk more about the Gary Master Plan update. Mr. Mays, thank you very much for being with us and hope things go well with not only the meeting this evening, but also all the other workshop meetings coming up in the future and hope to find out more on how this plan is coming together in the future as well, too. Thank you for being with us today. More Lake County communities are getting involved in the county's composting operation. Solid Waste Management District Executive Director John Manier told us recently here on Regionally Speaking that work is underway on a site in Crown Point, and the town of Highland will someday have a formal composting operation that could in turn serve several communities.
The programs are going very well. This last fall season we had a lot more leaves than what we've had in the past. We probably went over by about 2,000 yards from prior years, but our space capacity is going really well. The material's breaking down actually very well. We plan on doing some screening at our Gary site and getting ready for hopefully a spring sell of some finished compost. So things are going well. We are currently working on our registration for the City of Crown Point's site. We hope to get that one ready to go by this fall. Get last year's material put into windrows and be ready for the fall.
Now, where was Crown Point site going to be located?
It's located at their sewer plant. It's a location where they had taken leaves before and then switched to some locations out in the country. And now we're going to actually build a facility out there, put some grindings down like we have done at the Gary site and make that facility usable.
Okay, tell us about Highland, since that's the latest one to be added to the mix, or will be eventually when things move along in there.
Yeah, Highland's actually an exciting site because its location is really perfect. There's not a whole lot around there other than the interstate. And but there have been wood waste material that have been taken there before, and it's actually at their old landfill site. So we're going to be doing some work out there, getting the site ready to accept, hopefully leaves in the 2018 season. The nice thing about that site is it's close enough to Munster, who's taking their leaves out to Gary. That will end up saving them some transportation and potentially even the town of Dyer, depending on, you know, what they want to do. So that site has the opportunity to save communities some money provide some positive material for us and potentially even do some food waste, because there's a local business out there that's approached us with some of their material. It's very organic, and it's not, you know, it's a vegetable organic material, so it would work in well with the material.
One of the things I know that had been talked about in the past, and you'd mentioned earlier in your plans going into 2017, was to continue on the goal of zero waste. What's the status of that project right now?
Well, as I told the board, our focus is putting together all of our business templates, our plan, how we're going to implement that on the residential, commercial, and business sectors. We're looking at talking to some of the local universities and doing some partnerships there. So 2017 is going to be kind of our planning and development years, and then 2018 will begin with the actual implementation of what we develop this year. So we're calling the program A Journey to Zero, because it's going to be just that. It's going to be a journey. We're not going to get there. We're not even setting a date of when we're going to get there. We're just going to work really hard each year at continuing to put in better purchasing practices, better management practice of material, better ways to recycle, more efficient ways, and get communities thinking about possibly doing better diversions. And there's a lot of opportunities with some of our local businesses that people aren't aware of. So when we get our new website developed, which we hope to have finished by this spring, all of those businesses that currently offer some kind of recycling, we're going to add them to our list, so people will know in their area where they can recycle their oils, where they can recycle their clothes, where they can recycle their wood, where they can recycle, you know, whatever they're generating from their home, sometimes drywall or a host of materials. So we're looking at developing some of those partnerships. And so in 2018, we hope to be able to hit the ground running with that program.
Now, since Zero Waste is a pretty ambitious project in itself, obviously the state is coming back to try to revamp its standards, and in turn to reduce the amount of waste statewide that's going into landfills across Indiana. Have you had a chance to talk with the people at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management about what the Zero Waste program is all about, to let them know, to keep them in the loop, so to speak?
Yes, we've been down to Indianapolis and talked to them. We actually had talked to Governor Pence, now Vice President-elect Pence, his staff, when we began to look at the implementation of this. So the folks down at the state are aware that our board did pass a resolution adopting a zero waste strategy in 2016, and they kind of know what our timeline is. I'm going down February to do a presentation on our zero waste and our composting operations there.
You know, the folks at IDM seem to be interested in what you're doing, at least what they know right now?
Yeah, they're very excited about it. From what I understand, we're one of the first districts in the state of Indiana to actually adopt a zero waste strategy. There's a lot of universities around the state. Indiana's been doing some stuff with Indiana University's been doing some zero waste. I think Butler has been doing some stuff, IUPUI. So there's a lot of activity with the universities doing this.
Well, you also have the Subaru automotive facility in Lafayette, too, that we already know is already at zero waste.
Yeah, exactly. The business communities have been leading the charge on doing this, because there's potentially some strong financial incentives for them. So we're encouraged by what we're seeing, the trends going, and at least from a community standpoint, we're a little bit out in front of that trend going in Indiana. But we believe that there's going to be more and more people that will get involved and start adopting zero-waste strategies. The goal right now is set by the legislature at 50%. But again, we believe that the trend is going to be to adopt programs that focus on zero waste. We just want to go ahead and start the process now, and who knows when we'll get there, but we're going to keep fighting and keep working towards it.
That's Lake County Solid Waste Management District Executive Director John Menier. Conversation we had after one of the recent board meetings. Near the end of 2016, the Carrier Plant story went big. Donald Trump came to Indianapolis announcing that he helped save hundreds of the company's jobs from leaving the country. 1 mile away, workers at the Rexnord plant watched with mixed emotions. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Drew Daudlin reports, the 300 men and women losing their jobs at Rexnord are facing a harsh reality similar to millions of working-class Americans.
I mean, this truly is the calm before the storm, because that storm is coming, and it'll be here in just a few weeks for 300 people.
Tim Mathis makes a daily one-hour trip to work at a ball bearings factory on the west side of Indianapolis. He's about to lose his job because the factory, run by Rexnord Corporation, is moving to Monterrey, Mexico. The average salary the company pays its workers will drop from about $25 an hour to about $3 an hour. Mathis says things have been tense at the plant.
Is Rexnord a patriotic, good American citizen? Absolutely not. Not in my opinion. In my opinion, they've committed the ultimate act of betrayal.
Mathis is 51, and he's been through this before, so he knows what's coming. He worked at a factory in Greensburg until his job there was shipped overseas. He says closings like these have deep, far-reaching consequences.
I mean, one day you're going to hear, did you hear about Joe? Joe lost his home. And, you know, before long you're going to hear about somebody else whose wife divorced him. And then you're going to hear about somebody else that took his life.
I met Mathis at Sully's Bar and Grill. We can see the Carrier plant across the street. That's the factory Donald Trump often brought up at campaign rallies and during the first presidential debate when he promised to incentivize companies to stay in America.
All you have to do is take a look at Carrier Air Conditioning in Indianapolis. They left, fired 1,400 people. They're going to Mexico. So many hundreds and hundreds of companies are doing this. We cannot let it happen.
Months later, Trump partially followed through on his promise when Carrier announced that his influence kept hundreds of jobs from leaving. Mathis says it was bittersweet to watch the story unfold.
We were ecstatic. We were happy for the people of Carrier. We were hopeful for ourselves. We were hopeful for all the workers in America, all the people that are losing their jobs.
The Rexnord workers are losing their jobs, but they still don't know when. Mathis can't take a new job without knowing when his old one will end. And if he quits early, he'll lose his severance package, 1 week's pay for each of the 12 years he spent working at the plant.
For myself and my family, we're going to need that money to move forward.
There are programs in place to help workers laid off as a result of foreign trade, namely the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program that helps them get certified for new types of jobs. Mathis doesn't know yet if he'll use it, but for him, getting a job isn't the problem. The challenge is getting a job that pays the salary he's used to and learning new skills at an age when most people hope to be a career veteran.
Once again, we start over. The older you get, to start over, the harder it gets.
The U.S. lost 5 million manufacturing jobs between 2000 and 2014, according to the Economic Policy Institute. The reasons behind that trend are a whole nother story, but Mathis, like President Trump, blames trade deals like NAFTA for what's happened to him.
Our lawmakers have to be able to see this. They're the ones that have to stop the bleeding. It's got to stop. At some point, if it continues, where do we work? Where do our kids work?
He says young workers will have to fight for better trade laws, or these kinds of high-paying manufacturing jobs could be a thing of the past. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Drew Dudlin in Indianapolis.
Faith leaders, lawyers, politicians, and residents spoke on Sunday at a rally in Indianapolis to support immigrant protections. The rally comes at the end of a tense weekend for immigrant communities after reports that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has been conducting aggressive deportation raids in a handful of states. ICE officials said in a statement that the raids were routine. Alicia De Los Santos, an Indianapolis-area resident, told the crowd that her husband is currently being deported.
14 de septiembre, mi esposo salió, iba a ir a componer a su carro el mecánico y él ya no regresó.
On the 14th of September, my husband took his car to the mechanic and he never came home.
De Los Santos has four children, and her story highlights the worry that some have that mass deportations that President Trump has vowed to carry out would tear families apart. Faith leaders at the rally called for Indianapolis to become a sanctuary city, despite the fact that Indiana law essentially prohibits them. Mayor Joe Hogsett didn't mention sanctuary cities in his speech, but he did say that his administration would make a commitment.
To ensure that not one dime of city resources fund anything that a court has determined to be discriminatory or unconstitutional.
Marion County Sheriff John Layton was scheduled to speak at the rally, but he did not attend. IndyCan called on a delegation to meet with Sheriff Layton sometime today. The Chicago Auto Show draws car enthusiasts from across the country to see the latest trends and innovations. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore takes us to the show to see how innovations in steel manufacturing means a better future for steelworkers here in Northwest Indiana.
At the Chicago Auto Show, there are several trends in new cars this year. The biggest one, safety. The new Volvo, for example, has a goal that by 2020, no one will be killed in a new Volvo.
What it's designed to do is, with a radar and camera, identify an object which could be, you know, a potential threat, give a forward, what we call a forward collision warning to the driver. So that's telling them that there's some sort of action that's needed. So we have a row of red LEDs that will light up the windshield to get your attention to the road. If there's not enough evasive maneuvers that are done, the car will automatically apply the brakes. Most injuries in the United States occur because a car leaves a roadway. So the camera system develops essentially a digital wall along the edge of the road. It identifies the edge of the road. And if the car starts to veer towards that, it'll apply steering force to gently bring the car back onto the roadway.
So it'll right itself?
Yeah, it'll right itself, yes.
On the Nissan Rogue, the around view monitor and the emergency braking system are highlights.
When you're backing out of a parking spot, there's a 360-degree camera, so you can see all sides of the car as you're backing up, and it comes with moving object detection also. So there's an additional radar that will detect if somebody, a person or an animal or something, is walking behind you and you don't see it.
Is that new?
It will
this
alert
year?
You. It's not new this year, but that is a technology that we're seeing in more and more of our vehicles. New this year on the Rogue is forward emergency braking with pedestrian detection. So if you're driving on the highway and the car in front of you stops abruptly and you don't see it, it will alert you that the car is stopping and then slam on the brakes for you to mitigate that collision.
On the Chevy Equinox, teen driver is standard, and also rear seat reminder.
A parent can set certain controls that do things like control the volume until the seatbelt is buckled. You can monitor speed, and it'll shoot out a report card so you can have, you know, a good conversation about, you know, safe driving habits. Then rear seat reminder, it's a function that works when you open the door to the rear seat before you open the door to the front seat. If you're loading in groceries or, you know, a person, anything like that, the car will beep at you to remind you that there's something in the back seat. You know, in hot cars in the summer, you know, things get left behind and we just want to, you know, do everything that we can to make sure people keep all of their passengers and belongings safe.
The car industry is a big deal for folks in Northwest Indiana. That's because the car industry is the second largest customer for Northwest Indiana Steel, behind construction. That's according to the Steel Market Development Institute, a trade group for steel giant Arsenal Mittal. Advanced high-strength steel for cars means more security for jobs for steel workers in Northwest Indiana.
You have a great future because the innovation in the industry will help the automakers continue to use steel, and that certainly secures jobs. And if you look at the fastest growing material on a vehicle, it's advanced high strength steel. So it has been growing and has exceeded industry forecasts for the last 3 years in a row. We're using more of the newer steels because they're more efficient to design. So they're stronger, which makes it easier for the engineer to design the vehicle for its performance and its mass reduction.
So it's definitely in high need.
Oh, it's definitely in high need. It's replacing other steel. So the steels that were around in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, 70s has been replaced with these new grades of steel.
At the Chicago Auto Show, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
Some diabetics can go to extreme lengths to find inexpensive test strips to make sure that their blood sugars are within limits. Side Effects Public Media takes a look at what is being called the gray market for this very important item.
Americans spend more than $245 billion a year on diabetes care. About $4 billion of that goes to diabetic test strips. These disposable little pieces of plastic are essential to diabetics who can go through several a day to monitor their blood sugar. All that testing can get expensive, though. And as Side Effects Public Media's Bram Sable-Smith reports, that's created an informal and unregulated medical supply market.
Diabetics know the drill. Prick your finger, draw a little blood, and put it on a test strip that gets read by a meter. One test, one strip. And diabetics like Tim Rushing from Northwest Indiana do this
probably 4 to 8 times a day.
Rushing was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes about a year ago at age 50. He says he knew monitoring his blood sugar would be important to managing the disease, but he didn't know how much it would cost. Turns out, it's a lot. Even with insurance, the test strips his doctor prescribed cost about 50 cents a piece. That's $4 a day or 120 bucks a month.
So I started looking online, found out that I could get a box of 50 test strips from Amazon for 12 bucks.
That's about $60 a month, half the price.
That's what I've been doing ever since. Never even filled my prescription.
And Rushing has a steady job with insurance working in IT. So imagine how important getting cheaper strips would be for lower income or uninsured diabetics. Here in Missouri, where I live, for example, 1 in 10 people have diabetes. And 20% of them make less than $15,000 a year. That's the demand side of this informal market. And as for the supply side, I tried calling several test strip dealers who post ads on Craigslist offering cash for unused test strips.
All right. And your name is Brian?
Bram.
But even though there's nothing inherently illegal about this market, when they found out I was recording for this story, most people didn't want to talk.
You tell me you're a reporter. We in the general public, we've been lied to by you folks too many times, okay?
The real story that you should be running is why the drug companies are making billions of dollars and people can't even afford their supplies.
Hold on.
I did find one person who was willing to speak with me, though. He'd only give me his first name, Chris. He's 28. He says he's been in the business for about 5 years, and he buys leftover test strips from people who no longer need them.
Typically because doctors like to switch brands on them, so they're left with these extra boxes that they're just going to end up throwing out.
So Chris pays 10 to 20 bucks for a box that might cost $50 in a pharmacy. Then he can turn around and sell them. And even if he doubles the price, it'd still be cheaper for a lot of people than buying them in a store. But some say that also raises a couple problems. Roseanne Perugin is a special agent with the Office of Inspector General in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She says it's hard to verify the quality of informal market test strips, meaning
you're running a risk of getting inaccurate readings and having your blood sugar way out of whack.
And second is the cost to the rest of us.
Diabetic testing strips is an area that's really rife with fraud.
If someone orders too many test strips through government insurance like Medicare and flips the extras, taxpayers just subsidize that profit. And a 2011 investigation found over $400 million of questionable Medicare billing for test strips in that year alone. It's hard to say how much of that is actually fraud, though, and Chris says none of his strips come that way. For consumers like Tim Rushing, it's almost impossible to know where his strips come from. And while he does wonder, he says for now, he'll keep paying cash and saving money. Bram Sable-Smith, Side Effects Public Media.
Side Effects Public Media is a journalism collaborative that provides general information on topics related to health. It's Monday, and that means it's time once again to hear from John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Peter Oglinskas, who has a really interesting project that I just recently learned about. Peter, you're with IU Northwest, but at the Brouwer Museum of Art at Valparaiso University. You're presenting a film noir series.
That's right. I pitched this to the director there, Greg Herzlieb, about 4 years ago. I was checking out his stacks in the back room there, and I mentioned to him, how about doing a film series? And how about a film series on a specific topic of film noir?
Mm-hmm.
And his piqued his curiosity. And then I said, let's take it a step further and make it a film lecture series. After each film, then we have a lecture and discuss the films, and that's what it's evolved into.
So is this the first year for it?
Actually, it's the third season.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You're a seasoned veteran of this.
We are definitely have a hot product here. The first film that we showed this season, Black Angel, in January, was standing room only. We had to pull out two extra flanks of chairs.
Oh, good.
So it's really taken off. There are several people, well, groups of people who've been there from the first one to the most recent one.
And has it been film noir for all
the... All film noir, yes.
Yeah.
And film noir from the classic film noir period, which was from 1940 to 1959.
Yeah. Well... Yeah. Is Chinatown? I know that Chinatown doesn't fall in that range, but is that considered to be film noir?
Chinatown falls under the category of neo noir.
Okay.
So, in fact, Chinatown was one of the flagships of that genre, perhaps immediately preceding it, French Connection 2. So right around the end of the 50s, early 60s, people veered away from those kind of dark topics of noir and wanted big, splashy, CinemaScope spectacle films, Sand and Sandals and all that stuff.
Right.
And then around the early 70s, there was a rekindling of interest in noir and noirish themes.
Yeah, and well... So the Philip Marlowe movies, that's film noir.
Sure.
And what's your favorite film noir movie?
Oh, people jump to that early on.
Yeah.
I have to go to Kiss Me Deadly.
And who is in that?
Kiss Me Deadly stars Ralph Meeker in absolutely his best role. Meeker as the Mike Hammer private eye detective based on the novel by Mickey Spillane. And it's a little late in the cycle. It's 1955. But it incorporates and polishes so many of the noir themes and elements, and even incorporates some kind of atomic age freakout elements.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of my faves.
So what's still up on the schedule for this season?
Coming up for this season on the 16th of this month, February 16th, we're going to be showing Gun Crazy. And Gun Crazy is actually a very significant film. It was entered into the Library of Congress roster of most significant American films.
Mm.
And it is both a getaway film and an amour fou, a film about crazy love, two star-crossed lovers who are both, as the title says, gun crazy. Classic noir in that... In noir, things don't end well. And not to give anything away about the film,
people don't live happily ever after.
Correct. And that's a big change. That's where that title, film noir, came about, how it came about. There was a paucity of American films during World War II in France, and then all of a sudden, after the war, this flood of these dark films with not happy endings and that had a mood of cynicism and menace flooded Paris. And the film critics just said, what's going on in America? It's not all happy endings and Busley Berkeley follies anymore.
Huh.
And so, yes, that's the genesis of the name film noir.
And what do you teach at IUN?
IUN, I'm in the Fine Arts Department, in the music program of the Fine Arts Department. I teach music appreciation, but also courses that I created called The Soundscape of Pulp Fiction. This fall, I'm going to be teaching a course related to the lecture series that I created, The Noir Style in Image, Word, and Sound, upon which this Thursday Night Noir at the Brower is based, really. And also taught some rock music history, so courses.
So film noir is kind of a personal interest of yours.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
So it's certainly a focus of not only entertainment but scholarship as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very important art form.
So if people want to get the schedule, et cetera, where do they go?
The schedule, they can go online to valpo.edu/brower. -museum-of-art, the Brouwer Museum of Art website.
Good. Okay.
And they have all the information there.
Well, that's an easy website to find.
Indeed. Yeah, and it's in the Brouwer Museum, which is in the Fine Arts Building. Free parking just east of the museum, having gone to downtown Chicago twice this last weekend. It sure ain't free downtown.
No, it certainly isn't. Yeah, even if you do it right, you still have to pay $30.
That's right.
Okay, well, Peter, great to have met you recently. Great to have had you here. And I think that the series sounds fantastic.
I look forward to having people come to check out Thursday Night Noir at the Brouwer. Thank you, Jen.
And I'm going to come too.
Oh, looking forward to it.
Okay, thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
It's John Kane, and you can hear him next Monday with Eye on the Arts here on Regionally Speaking. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for listening. We have community activist Ruth Needleman with us in the studio tomorrow.